Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
A surprise defection this week as Conservative Eve Adams crosses the floor to the Liberals. Not only that, but in the next election, she wants to go head-to-head with the Federal Finance Minister. This has sparked a lot of debate within the Liberal Party, and we'll hear from grits on both sides of the argument.
McLean's panel weighs in on the Adams affair and discusses the Prime Minister's cabinet shuffle, which has put new ministers in the Departments of Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Employment.
What to do about the growing anti-vaccine movement? Some parents are choosing not to immunize their children, even as measles spread through Ontario and Quebec. Is it time for national mandatory vaccinations? Dr. Gregory Taylor, the Chief Public Health Officer of Canada, is here to discuss the problem.
And the Canadian flag turns 50 years old this weekend. For the last 5 decades, the red and white flag with a solo maple leaf has been a symbol of pride for every Canadian. With a look back at how the flag was chosen, we speak with the last living person who was tasked with creating the design of the flag in 1965.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. You could hear the gasp from reporters on Monday as Eve Adams, the MP for Mississauga Brampton South, walked into the National Press Theatre in Ottawa with Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. The longtime Conservative, who had joined the PCs when she was just 14 years old, decided to cross the floor to the Grits. She didn't leave quietly either, taking some parting jabs at the Prime Minister.
I can no longer support mean-spirited leadership that divides people instead of bringing them together. We need a kind, generous, and strong leadership that champions a shared vision for how to make Canada work for everyone. I want to work with someone who inspires, not with fearmongers and bullies.
But the surprises didn't end there. A couple of days later, Adams announced she would be seeking the Liberal nomination in the riding of Eglinton-Lawrence, the seat currently held by Finance Minister Joe Oliver. Her fiancé, Dimitri Soutis, supports the move. He is the former Director of Communications for the Prime Minister and the former Executive Director of the Conservative Party. He lost his job because of his involvement in a nasty nomination battle Adams was fighting.
Now, last year, Adams made headlines over that nomination because she and her opponent accused each other of misconduct, both later pulling out of the race. Prime Minister Stephen Harper dismissed Adams' defection, saying she only flipped to the Grits because the Conservatives didn't want her.
The National Council of our party is responsible for an honest, clean nomination process. It informed MP Adams some 10 days ago that she could not be a candidate for the party for reasons that I think everybody understands. And that's obviously the reality of the situation, and that's the sole reason we obviously have the development we have today.
So Adams says she left as a matter of principle, but the Conservatives say she was pushed out. No matter how it happened, it is fair to say a lot of Liberals are not happy with their new member, and one of them is Liberal MPP Michael Cole. In the Ontario legislature, he represents Eglinton-Lawrence, and he was quick to condemn this move by Adams, saying she'll run over his dead body. He spoke about his frustrations with our Ottawa station 1310 News in an interview with host Ed Hand.
Well, what I don't like about it is that there's no respect for the fact that someone running in a riding should at least have a connection with the riding, live there, connect with issues, someone that the people know, and to have someone come in from outside of the city of Toronto and also from another party who was just a member of the other party a day ago and then say they're going to be the anointed one for a riding sort of really ruffles a lot of people's feathers who are just ordinary folks who want to vote for someone they can trust.
She says the previous riding doesn't represent her values. Maybe Eglinton-Lawrence does. Do you feel that way?
Well, how would she know? She's never had anything to do with Eglinton-Lawrence, and so it's kind of a real stretch. She's gotten bad advice, and she doesn't know the people of Eglinton-Lawrence are not going to take this, without a fight. Liberals and everyone else alike. So it's just bizarre. The whole thing is bizarre. That's what I sort of surmise it as.
You haven't had any phone calls from Justin Trudeau or anybody else?
No, I haven't. I don't think I'm on everybody's favorite list because I've, I think, stirred up something. But, you know, I had to speak up on behalf of the, you know, ordinary people that volunteer in elections, that, you know, put up signs and knock on doors. And they just can't be taken for granted for some kind of backroom decision, you know, anointing some candidate who, again, you know, has never paid their dues.
What I'm wondering, you mentioned that, you know, you've worked with the federal liberals there in their campaigns and helped out. I'm wondering, did you hear from any of those folks after this announcement?
Well, I haven't heard one positive comment about the possibility of Eve Adams, you know, seeking the nomination. I haven't, not one, all negative. And these are, again, people that are unsolicited, that just there's nobody saying, hey, this is a good idea. You know, it's everybody's either shocked or just totally negative towards this possibility.
So what do Liberal MPs think about their new caucus colleague and the controversy surrounding her defection? I spoke on the phone with John McCallum, the Liberal MP for Markham Unionville. So I guess, first of all, John, what was your, I guess, initial reaction when you saw that Eve Adams was joining the Liberal caucus?
The caucus was pre-informed at 8:45, so I wasn't surprised when I saw her walk on the stage, but I certainly was surprised to hear the news.
Was it a good surprise, I guess?
Well, when I absorbed it, I think, yes, it was a good surprise. I mean, she's evidently completely unhappy with the way Stephen Harper's leading the country and also with the income splitting measure. So if she wins the nomination, which remains to be seen, then she'll take on Joe Oliver. And I think her main issue with him is going to be over this income splitting. But I think that would be an interesting contest.
What have you heard from liberals on this? There has been a fair amount of criticism leveled by columnists and analysts and critics at the Liberals and at your leader, Mr. Trudeau, about accepting Eve Adams into caucus. How are Liberals feeling about the decision?
Well, look, I guess there's mixed feelings. I know some of us Liberals reached out to her right away. Others might have been more reticent, but the decision has been made, and I'm sure we will all welcome her into the caucus. As you know, there's been some negative reaction in the riding, but that is perhaps not altogether surprising. And she will have a tough contest to win the nomination, and not everybody will support her. And she's shown herself to be a fighter, so I think she has a decent chance. I don't know. But it's up to her to convince enough Liberals in the riding to support her. And if she can, then she will be our candidate. And if she can't, then she won't.
In the meantime, though, she'll be sitting in caucus. There's a story from Post Media today quoting, you know, some on the record, some off the record Liberal MPs. One off the record MP says, quote, "The larger population just got another message saying the Liberals are no different than the Conservatives," unquote. Are you worried about that? Do you get the sense that your Liberal colleagues are concerned about things? Are you concerned about her being in caucus with you?
No, I sent a tweet out saying I welcomed her to the caucus, and I stand by that message. I think when decisions are made, not everybody is always 100% in agreement, but I think we do function as a team and we will work together. And I am sure that all of us will welcome her to the caucus.
What about just in terms, though, of the idea that Mr. Trudeau has put forward of doing politics differently, of fighting cynicism? In this case, you have an MP who's been subject to various controversies. You also have an MP who's crossing the floor. Does this undermine the idea that Mr. Trudeau is trying to put forward of what himself and a Liberal government would be about?
I don't think so. I look, she has to win the nomination. Mr. Trudeau has given her that opportunity. but the rest is up to her. If she cannot convince enough local Liberals to overcome their concerns about her, then she will not win the nomination. So it's consistent with Justin Trudeau's concept of open nominations. That is what she will subject herself to and possibly win and possibly not. So I think that is not inconsistent with his modus operandi.
How you've been in Parliament, what's your general sense of how floor crossing in general is handled by voters?
Well, look, we did have a lengthy discussion in caucus a couple of weeks ago, not naming any names, but in principle. And so the general consensus in our caucus was that, you know, subject to people having to run the, not given it on a plate, but having to win the nomination, if they genuinely want to join us, then we would not, we would accept that in principle. We didn't discuss names, but I think the general sentiment in the Liberal caucus was that as long as people are required to win the local nomination, and if they clearly show that they share our values and our principles, then we would be happy to receive them. And it happens that she was the first case to materialize following this conversation. And maybe there will be others, we don't know. But I think as a matter of principle, we're not opposed to this idea.
Do you think, though, that voters may find it hard to accept? I mean, this is an MP who, you know, just a week ago was very happy to sort of support the government line on things.
Well, people keep saying that she argued in favor of income splitting in the last campaign, but, you know, so did Jim Flaherty. So I don't really think that that is a negative. I think people change their minds. It's not unethical to change one's mind on certain issues. Even Winston Churchill crossed the floor twice, and others have. And now, sometimes, you're right, voters will react negatively. But in other cases, take Scott Bryson. He's been elected a good number of times in his riding, having switched from being a progressive conservative to a liberal. So in that case, the voters were fine with it. So I think it's a case-by-case basis, and one can't generalize.
That was Liberal MP John McCallum.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Aaron Wherry, the Associate Editor for Maclean's, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Thanks very much for being here. All right, so the Eve Adams issue. I'll start off by asking a question I think a lot of people had on Monday. What the heck happened?
Yeah, that's, I think there was a lot of guessing going on the Hill about what exactly that announcement was going to be, and I don't think anybody had Eve Adams in the pool.
You could hear that.
Yeah.
The audible gasp from everybody in the National Press Theater.
I still don't know what to make of it entirely. Let's take this in two parts. First, is this a net gain for the Liberals? Have they gained anything out of this? Well, they have a sitting MP, they have another seat, they have a candidate who's shown some ability to win a riding. On the other hand, they have a candidate an MP who's shown, you know, that she's not exactly immune to controversy, I guess. These little controversies that have come up throughout her time on the Hill. So I'm really not sure how this pans out. I think there's maybe two problems for Trudeau. One is the brand, and whether the idea of him as a sort of new style politician is in any way impaired by this. And the other is exactly what is the long-term play here? Like, does this benefit in the end? And I don't know. I keep trying to figure out whether this matters at all, really. Like, whether the voters in general will care, or whether this is just sort of an odd story we've had for this week. And 8 months from now in October, we will have forgotten about it.
John, the conservatives are saying, good riddance, your problem now, we never liked her anyway. The liberals are saying, this is great, look, we attracted over a conservative MP, and not only that, they also apparently are going to get some help from Dimitri Sudis, at least on Eve Adams' campaign. Her fiancé, who was the former director of communications for the prime minister and executive director of the party. Who actually wins in this defection here?
It's a victory for democracy. No, I'm just joking. It is the liberals losing this. People are sweating the angles here. The liberals losing this. Here's why they lose. To the vast population, this doesn't mean anything. Eve Adams is not like a floor caster like David Emerson or even Belinda Stronach, who had national name recognition. She doesn't. So let's might as well just erase this front as an issue about the national consciousness of it. So where does it matter? It matters in Toronto, in places where she's known, and in the media bubble, where it's one of those markers for what kind of a politician is Justin Trudeau. So let's just think about those roles. In Toronto, she is tainted goods, brings the most awkward baggage you could possibly ask for, a person who was not wanted in her own riding. The Tories were not going to let her run anywhere. So that's, come on now, that's not a good get for you. People want to dismiss the media bubble chatter about this, but I don't think it should be dismissed. Justin Trudeau's, part of his advantage has been his credibility and being able to see, and Aaron alluded to this, to say he's a new type of politician. He wasn't playing the old games, some of the sort of hard-nosed politics that was associated really with the Paul Martin camp of the Liberal Party, that was gone. Well, this is a weird, cynical move. To bring someone in who has that kind of background, who's hooked up with Dimitri Sudis, one of the hardest ball players in the Harper circle, and to suggest that somehow liberals in Toronto somewhere might want to embrace her as a candidate? Why? And we've already seen that the riding she's putatively going to be running in, there are people there who don't want her. The local MPP has said, over my dead body. So I think this is a clear losing move for the Liberals. The question is how big a losing move. I'm presuming they'll try to move past it, and fortunately for them, we're still many months, probably better part of 8 months out from an election still, but wow, not a smart move.
All right, so on Monday, right after that announcement,
we had a cabinet shuffle.
That was a very busy day for a lot of people on the Hill. But we had that cabinet shuffle where Jason Kenney was moved into defense from employment. Filling in employment is Pierre Poilievre. And taking over the gap left by John Baird in foreign affairs is Rob Nicholson, the former defense minister. Was this a good shuffle in your eyes? Is this what the prime minister needed to do to fill in that gap left by Baird and show some strength in his cabinet?
I think it was a slightly actually just surprising shuffle. I was surprised to see Kenny go into defense. For some reason I thought he'd go into foreign affairs. I thought that's where they would want his talent and his ability as a communicator. But maybe he goes into defense and he starts to straighten things and some things out there. The other move, the Poilievre move, I think he was probably in line for a promotion. It seems surprising to me that he was in line for that promotion. That's a big job. Being the employment minister, being the guy who has to talk about jobs in this economy, in this situation leading into an election, that is a big job. So first of all, how is he going to be able to handle the communication end of it? Can he come off credible to the public? And then second of all, how can he work with the provinces and other stakeholder groups to kind of advance the agenda at this point? It's a big job for him. I mean, I'm one of those people who has some time for Pierre Poilievre. A lot of other people maybe don't, but I think he's talented, but this is a big test of his ability to do things.
To mature a bit in politics. Eh?
The one thing in Democratic reform was that he, maybe he got that bill passed, but it was an ugly passing of a bill. It was a big fight. It had some really ugly moments, and I don't really know if that's what you want in appointment.
Aaron's covered Pierre Poilievre pretty well, so let me deal with the other two guys in this mix. What we see here is some facts about cabinet jobs coming to the fore, right? The foreign affairs job is often really the deputy foreign affairs job because the prime minister is foreign minister, right? There's a sort of it's kind of an axiom that often prime ministers, not always, but often they're their own foreign minister. And so a guy like Nicholson, who really is a guy who reads the talking points, doesn't show a lot of creativity, doesn't bring a lot of flair to the job, is probably okay under a prime minister who really wants to be his own foreign minister right now. So that makes sense in a certain way. Jason Kenney to defense, why does that make sense? Jason Kenney has shown an ability to fix some files, to actually not just sort of communicate, kind of be a presence, but actually get some stuff done. You can always debate about how he gets it done, but he moves some stuff. Defense is a file where stuff needs to be done right now. They need to fix especially the problems they've been having with procurement, and I suspect that's why Kenney's being put there, because the idea is he can actually take hold of a tough file and do something with it. The problem with this mix, of course, is the one that many people pointed out. Although Kenney may make more sense as a functional minister of defense, as a public presence, he would make more sense in foreign affairs, where he speaks French, and you know would show a bit more of a sort of an elan for the job, a sort of a style. The one thing I mentioned on that, and I'm not sure if this would have factored in or not, when Kenney wasn't given foreign affairs, and like you, I kind of thought he might be. I was thinking back to 2011 when Pakistan's minister for minorities was assassinated. Kenney had known this fellow and was very broken up about his death. It was quite touching to speak with him. He was very disturbed by the whole thing. It was a human reaction, but it also showed the depth of feeling Kenney has for some foreign affairs files, including questions about minority rights. And I just have to wonder whether or not the Prime Minister and the PMO might have worried a bit about putting a guy who has that passion into the job, a guy who is actually going to want to advance, probably in an aggressive way, some files that maybe bring a political risk with them. I'm not even sure that's why. I suspect it was more they wanted him defense, but I wonder if they wouldn't see a potential downside to Kenney in foreign affairs, a guy who would be hard to control from the PMO.
With the Kenney Nicholson appointments, is there some election tactics involved in all of this? Jason Kenney has proven to be great in a campaign, yeah. Especially in his multiculturalism file. He's got a lot of votes for the Conservatives. That's a guy you want to stay in the country in the 9 months leading up to an election, as opposed to having him globetrot.
Yeah, that makes sense. I hadn't thought about that. You think just this job allows him to be at home, do some of his other work. Huh? You might be
while
right.
Keeping the multiculturalism file on.
The first
combination defense multiculturalism minister.
It's a huge job.
It is interesting. I think Rob Nicholson is much more in line with the foreign ministers we had, as John says, before Baird, Cannon, Bernier, etc. Yeah. The other thing with Nicholson was his limitations, to my mind, became apparent when there was a controversy over what exactly we're doing in Iraq and the role our soldiers are playing. There had been this whole controversy over whether or not our soldiers were accompanying Iraqi soldiers. And the word accompany was fairly important. And when questioned about it in the House, Nicholson stood up and made a joke about the word accompany as if it didn't matter. And then, went into committee and got just knocked around by Mark Garnaut when asked for specifics on military deployments. So if this is going to get into a very detailed debate over Iraq and over what our soldiers are doing, you want a guy who's able to handle details and communicate them and respond to questions. And that's Jason Kenney.
Thanks very much, John Geddes, Ottawa Bureau Chief from Maclean's Magazine, Associate Editor from Maclean's, Aaron Wary, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Coming up on the show, we speak with Canada's Chief Public Health Officer about the anti-vaccination movement, and we speak with Patrick Reed, the last living person who helped design the Canadian flag back in 1965.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we celebrate the 50th birthday of the Canadian flag by speaking with the last living person who helped create its design back in 1965. But first,
the anti-vaccination movement has come under the spotlight recently as cases of measles continue to spread in Toronto and in Quebec. Some parents don't believe in immunizing their children, partially due to research that had suggested vaccines were linked to autism. But that study has since been debunked as fraudulent. Nonetheless, anti-vaxxers, as they're known, continue to spread the message that vaccines may be bad for people's health. In Ottawa, there is even a new daycare promising parents a vaccine-free environment for their kids.
But it looks like most of us aren't buying into the anti-vaxxer cause. A new study by Angus Reid finds that 88% of Canadians feel vaccinations are effective in preventing diseases, 83% say they will vaccinate their kids, and almost two-thirds say vaccinations should be mandatory. The vaccine debate is the focus of the cover story for this week's issue of Maclean's Magazine, looking not only at the anti-vaxxers, but also how the lack of public leadership and coordination has contributed to the problem. To speak more about this issue, I'm joined now by Dr. Gregory Taylor, Chief Public Health Officer of Canada.
My pleasure.
I guess, first of all, I'll just ask you about your general thoughts on this anti-vaccine movement that, you know, it's not really new, but it's definitely been under the spotlight, especially with measles cases being popping up in Toronto and Quebec. So what are your thoughts on this anti-vaxxer movement?
Yeah, this has been an issue for several years. As you mentioned, it's not new. It's really difficult to understand at one level because it's doesn't seem to be about evidence. The scientific evidence is crystal clear of the overwhelming benefits of vaccine. The measles in particular, kids who get measles or people who get measles, one in 250 get ear infections, one in 1,000 get brain infections, one in 3,000 die. The side effects from the vaccine and measles is one in a million estimates of kids who can get severe allergic reactions. Measles vaccine has been used for 50 years. We have millions and millions of doses around the world have been given. We know all kinds of knowledge and evidence about the effect and the millions of lives that have been saved. So I it seems a little irrational, and I think personally that I think it's fear-based, the concern about the vaccine. We've been doing a lot of work on that. It seems to be based in certainly in fear, in misinterpretation, in misinformation, in beliefs, fear and beliefs sometimes are a little bit irrational. I think that we need to continue to remind and engage with those individuals that the risks from the disease are far, far greater than the potential side effects of the vaccine.
Is it all based on this study that had linked vaccinations to things like autism that was later found out to be fraudulent? But is that where all the fears are coming from, or is there something more to this from this movement in this misinformation and this fear that you discuss?
Certainly the falsified study about autism didn't help matters. I also think part of the misinformation, some folks are thinking they don't need to vaccinate their kids anymore because we've been doing such a good job. The outbreaks we're experiencing right now in Canada counters that and shows that we do need to continue to worry about that because measles is one of the most contagious viruses on the planet. It spreads so quickly that the only real defense is vaccination. So I think there's a whole variety of reasons why people are choosing not to be vaccinated.
Do you think that the anti-vaccination movement has contributed to the spread of measles that we've seen recently?
Well, it's been relatively consistent. And there's some worry that there's less Canadians becoming immunized. Our surveys, we do surveys of vaccine uptake all the time to monitor this. Our surveys indicate, and we're trying to support those. These are self-reported surveys. We're trying to look at the records to support that. But they're indicating a 95% coverage rate with measles. And that's been relatively consistent for several years. So we don't have any hard evidence that vaccination rates are going down. We do have some evidence that there's concern, but none that they're going down. The measles we have in the last, I believe it's 10 years or so, it's ranged from lows of 6, and some years we have as high as 700 and some reported cases. Last year in 2014, I believe it was a little over 400 cases because there was an outbreak in British Columbia of several hundred in groups that were unimmunized. And so measles is very good at finding those people who are unimmunized and infecting them. So this year so far seems like a lot. I think the numbers is around 19 so far, and this is middle of February, month and a half. So that's not out of the ordinary that you wouldn't expect given the history we've had.
There's a study that came out saying that 2/3 of Canadians believe that vaccines should be mandatory across the country, and I know a couple of provinces do already have it as mandatory. So do you think that vaccination should be mandatory across Canada?
That's been an issue that's been discussed for many years as well. I think it's Ontario and New Brunswick actually are the two provinces that make it mandatory. Both provinces have a opt-out. I know in Ontario they make it very difficult. I believe they have to have signatures notarized, etc., but they can opt out. It's a tough one to decide. Certainly it's a jurisdiction that the provinces have to make those decisions, and it's tough to know if the evidence is good or bad for that. The approach we've used in Canada to date has been one of reassuring, giving the information, normalizing that it's just a normal thing you do, and I think encouraging folks to talk to their healthcare providers and talk to their doctors and have those ongoing conversations. The mandatory issue has been discussed for many years, and it's always a difficult one to decide what the best approach is.
So at this point, there is no federal plan to try and make this mandatory?
Well, like I said, it's a jurisdictional issue that it's the provinces and territories' responsibility to do that if they want. We have been working with the provinces and territories very closely for many years. We do have a national immunization strategy at the Public Health Network. I co-chair the council of that. We have a task group that is specifically looking, this is working with the provinces and territories, on the issue of vaccine hesitancy. Hesitancy is the kind of the professional term we call to label folks who are worried about that.
So you say that there's work with the provinces to tackle this issue, but there's no national computerized vaccine registry. And I know I've moved to a few different provinces, and when I get there, I get a new doctor and they ask me if I've been vaccinated. I don't have that yellow card or whatever it was I had as a kid, and I can't remember if I've been vaccinated for certain things. Why doesn't Canada have some sort of computerized registry for vaccinations so that no matter where you travel, you know, health officials can just look it up and know what you've been vaccinated for?
That's another issue that we have been working on for some time, and several of the provinces are adopting registries and are trying to roll them out. There was the Panorama software that has vaccine registries that we worked with collaboratively to develop. So it is in the works and it is being developed. At the provincial level, there can be a variety of different pieces of software to try and record that. So my understanding, several of the provinces are trying to implement those in a way that will do as you said. The other thing that we've done, I'm sure you're aware of the Immunize CA app that we sponsored to develop, and that's one where it replaces that yellow card. People can download this on their phones and their Blackberries and their iPads and, again, keep track of their vaccines and either have the get the information from the doctor and enter them there. Now, they're good for children, it's good for adults, and there's lots of really excellent information. So there's a variety of solutions to try and move us away from that yellow card that keeps disappearing. I know what you mean.
That was Dr. Gregory Taylor, Chief Public Health Officer of Canada.
Coming up on the show, we celebrate the Canadian flag's 50th birthday by speaking with Patrick Reed, who in 1965 helped design the iconic symbol of our nation.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
February 15th is the 50th anniversary of the first time Canada's Maple Leaf flag was flown over Parliament Hill. In the decades that have followed, the red and white flag has become an iconic symbol of our nation that Canadians look to with pride. In the run-up to the celebration, plenty has been written about the epic political battle fought in 1964 between Prime Minister Lester B. Pearson's Liberals, who wanted a distinctively Canadian flag, and John Diefenbaker's Conservatives, who wanted one that reflected British heritage. But McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes has been looking at another side of the flag story. John, what have you been looking into?
Yeah, Cormac, I'm fascinated by the flag story beyond politics, the actual graphic design work that went into the flag. It's a great logo. So the question is, who drew it? There had to be a professional hand at work there. Here's a quick version of what you need to know to get to that part of the story. In the 1963 election, Pearson promised to give Canada its own flag. He assigned an Ontario MP, John Matheson, to spearhead the project. A House of Commons committee, this is the famous part, had a bitter debate and finally voted in October 1964 for the single leaf concept. That was an idea that had first been proposed by a guy named George Stanley, who was Dean of Arts at the Royal Military College in Kingston, Ontario. So they've settled on a basic concept, but somebody had to actually design the flag. Pearson turns to Patrick Reed, who was then heading the government's Exhibitions Commission. Patrick Reed is 90 now, living in Vancouver, and I spoke with him by phone about how the flag came to be. What a great storyteller he is. Let him pick up the tale.
I was at the time the director of the Canadian Government Exhibition Commission, And I got a call from the Prime Minister's office I can't tell you the precise date. I'd have to look it up. And I was asked to take hold of the design of the Canadian flag. And I was well aware, as everybody who lived in Canada at the time, I guess, that there'd been a hell of a controversy over the thing. The Exhibition Commission at the time was very, very busy with the centennial coming up. And
you were doing Expo 67.
And Expo 67, and indeed making the first steps towards Expo 70.
Mm.
It wasn't something that I was going to argue about. That was an instruction from the Prime Minister. In fact, I was told that the Prime Minister himself had specified that I was the one to be approached.
Did he know you? Did Mr. Pearson know you?
Pardon?
Did you know Mr. Pearson? Did he know you or know of you?
I'd met him, but I think probably he was well aware of the Exhibition Commission.
Right.
Because he had been in London, obviously, as a diplomat in the earlier years, and the Exhibition Commission had an office in London, and under his jurisdiction. And we had a design capability which was really quite unique, and we were very proud, quite frankly.
I bet.
Anyway, the next thing that happened was John Matheson turned up, and he was the Prime Minister's point man on the flag, and he explained the thing in somewhat more detail. But the thing that struck me as very extraordinary at the time was that a committee of the House of Commons had agreed, after a certain amount of acrimony,
yes,
on some sort of a flag that had red and white in it, and a maple leaf. This wasn't anything particularly unusual to me, quite frankly, because we had been using red and white as national colors for 20 years. And also, maple leaf was obviously not unused. We had used it in one form or another on exhibits and displays and so on. The issue to me, really, was that there had been no criteria for all that to be put on a flag.
Right.
And there are some basic principles in designing a flag, obviously, like that it be the same on both sides, at least to me, anyway.
Sure.
That it be very simple,
mm-hmm,
and that it would be distinguishable as the national flag from a distance. All those sort of things. And there was none of that.
Right.
So I concocted the criteria and then looked around for somebody who could do some work on the design. And I settled on Jacques Saint-Cyr, who was a graphic designer, a very exceptional one. I had him in and said, "You're going to work on the Canadian flag," and he was a bit stunned because he was a Quebecer. He was a gentleman, but he most certainly was a Quebec nationalist.
Hmm.
Anyway, he gulped a bit and grinned and said, "Sure, okay, let's go." And then what we had to do was decide on the basic elements, not that we were going to argue with the committee of the House of Commons, but just how best we would do it.
Right.
And then I discovered that John Matheson was rather enamored of the natural maple leaf.
Oh, yeah.
And he wanted to know how that could be incorporated in the flag, and I said, absolutely not. And we had a big argument that went on for, 3 or 4 days. But I showed him, eventually, the various maple leaves that we had done, and most of all, and then by that time, in 1964, were stylized.
Hmm.
And so Jacques was asked to create a stylized maple leaf that would do the job on a national flag. And at the crucial point, one afternoon, Matheson phoned me and said that the Prime Minister wanted to see the flag flying at his residence in Ottawa the following morning.
Yes.
And so we went to sort of action stations, and eventually Jacques came up with a 13-point maple leaf in the center of, obviously, a flag with two red borders on it. Mm. And there were just three of us that night, actually. There was Matheson, who, incidentally, was a war hero and had been badly injured during the war. So as it went on during the evening, he got very tired, so we had a wheelchair. Mm. In which he sat, and there were two others. That was Jacques Saint-Cyr and myself. And I guess now I'm the only one left alive who was there at the time.
Yeah.
As the night wore on, Jacques finished a 13-pointer. And I think he himself was a little uneasy about the 12th and 13th points, which were down at the bottom. It just looked a little busy. And I asked him to experiment with bringing it down to 11 points, which was a real question, because we had done 13-pointers before, but never an 11-pointer, because you were almost getting to the point where it was failing to be a maple leaf, or it was something else. Mm. Jacques agreed and cut it down to 11 points, and it looked good.
To me, it's wonderful that we can still hear the story from a guy who was actually in the room the night our flag was finalized. Talk about living history. And just a footnote here, Cormac, on Jacques Saint-Cyr. He died in 1996, but I've spoken with some of his old colleagues, and they all stress that Saint-Cyr was a really sophisticated, modern graphic designer, very attuned to the design trends in the 60s that led to all the great architecture and furniture and what have you that exploded on the scene at Expo 67. We don't often see it this way, but our flag is really a piece of bold, streamlined, cool 1960s design. The expertise that went into that designing, that's the story that Patrick Reed has told us, is one of the reasons we still love it.
To read John's coverage of the story behind the creation of the flag, go to macleans.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.